The Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Good morning to you all. This is Richard Martin coming to you live from Singapore. And it is the 7th of February 2011. And I am glad to be with you. I'm sorry about the missed show on Friday, but we are back to normal, and so all is well. So, you've seen what appear to be improving statistics from the government on economic fundamentals. So what's going on? Have we turned the corner? Are we embarked on a brand new economic wave of prosperity? What is really happening here? Well, managing perception is the game plan, not fixing what ails the real economy. It's all about rescuing a politically sacrosanct and highly insolvent financial sector. According to some analysts, the so-called recovering U.S. economy is poised to enter a phase of explosive growth. Other analysts see evidence that the bogus recovery is teetering on the edge of implosion from any number of causes. High inflation, declining home values, high oil prices, etc. And so, what's the reality? Well, the real economy is so detached from the one presented by official data and the stock market that anything could be described as growth, explosive or modest, is a matter of managed perception. It's not reality. Central state intervention of massive spending and credit creation have had the effect of appearing to limit any kind of decline to one heavily smoothed by extended unemployment, food stamps, zero interest rates, Federal Reserve purchases of treasuries and mortgage instruments, and massive federal spending on everything from fighter jets to Medicare. The relentlessly managed perception is that the spot of bother we saw between 2008 and 2009 is history, and the situation has now been restored to normality, i.e. a rising stock market, super low interest rates, and unlimited central bank borrowing. You see, there are two key tools for managing perceptions: statistical evidence for rising profits, GDP, etc., and declining unemployment, and the rising stock market, which supposedly triggers a wealth effect in the 10% of the population with enough financial assets to be able to experience an increase in wealth. The reality is the official account of the real economy has near zero credibility. Officially, there is no increase in the consumer price index. Officially, unemployment has plummeted to 9%, painfully high perhaps, but an improvement that augurs well for future growth, so they say, and on and on. But three ugly manifestations of reality hold sway, and they are, of course, totally underplayed by the media and the government. One, a potentially unlimited number of credit-created dollars is chasing tangible goods. How long that dynamic will endure, nobody knows. But we do know the real world has limits, and credit creation does not. Two, the total number of employed people has barely increased in the past year, while the working age population has risen. If official numbers actually reflected reality, then the unemployment number would be rising, not falling. The unemployment statistics are all a shell game of switcheroo numbers, black box estimates of robust job growth in phantom small businesses, and so on. And three, the economy is now totally dependent on federal deficit spending to the tune of 10% of the entire GDP. That's a cool $1.5 trillion a year, borrowed and blown, and on the Federal Reserve's creation of money to buy U.S. Treasury bonds. Now, without these, the impaired state of the real economy would be starkly revealed, and the stupendous supply of new federal debt might overwhelm demand, pushing rates higher. In other words, the U.S. economy is now totally dependent on unlimited expansion of debt and credit creation by the central state and its proxies. Withdraw those, and the gap between the managed perception economy, or the propaganda facade, and the real economy vanishes. Reality would once again trump perception. The Fed's basic game plan is to replay the successful recapitalization of the crippled financial sector from the mid to late 1980s. The game plan then was to enable the debt-crippled banks to write down their impaired or uncollectible debts slowly and, as it were, earn their way out of a hole through low rates, flimsy accounting rules that hid the true scope of losses, and new markets for their so-called products. The same plan is being followed today, only the losses are massively higher. The Fed is 2 years into a multi-year plan to siphon off enough money from the productive economy to the financial sector so that its staggering losses in global real estate speculation can be written down slowly enough that profits will recapitalize the essentially insolvent banks. But the Fed is playing with explosives that weren't present in 1985. You have demographics, a fast-retiring baby boom generation which is pushing federal spending into exponential growth. You have shortages of grain and other real-world materials. And then you have a financial sector which has purchased control of the mechanisms of governments. Given the extraordinary levels of central state intervention and the global bond market's obedient acceptance of this intervention, the game can continue for quite some time. Two things could upset the Fed and the Treasury's game plan to fix what they perceive as the real problem, that is, recapitalizing an insolvent financial sector which controls the political machinery of the nation. Firstly, the bond market could suddenly refuse to buy into the story that the Fed can buy trillions of dollars in bonds and mortgages with no side effects whatever, and that the federal government can borrow 10% of GDP with no side effects whatsoever. This looks very much like it may already be happening. There has been and continues to be, as I speak, a sickening slide in bond prices over the last few weeks. If the bond market chokes, the Fed will have to buy most of the new and maturing Treasury debt indefinitely. Otherwise, rates rise, destroying the game plan of funneling free money to the banks via the zero interest rate policy. Secondly, the politicians could decide that the Fed and Treasury plan is pure folly and create unassailable opposition to the current madness. It's very difficult to predict which, if any, of these two alternatives might come about. Up to now, the game plan has been working smoothly. The stock market's rising, unemployment's falling, as per the managed perception campaign of statistical ledger domain, and the banks distributed $135 billion in profits, a hefty return on a paltry $3 billion invested in lobbying. Washington, D.C., politicos, the players. The only certainty right now is that the status quo is failing to address the real problems in the real economy. But managed perception is not the same as fixing what ails the real economy. The difference between the two is lost on the status quo, which is pursuing the equivalent of voodoo economics. If the people believe everything is fixed, then it's fixed. This is magical thinking at its finest, or worst. Reality will trump managed perception. It's just that nobody knows when. The entire status quo is completely dependent on sustaining the perception of growth and recovery, and we shouldn't underestimate the resources and hubris they are bringing to bear on propping up the facade. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I am Richard Martin. This is the Wake Up Call, and it's coming to you from Singapore. And it is being relayed through PRN in New York City. And you may call me, or us, you may call and air your rants and other comments or questions by calling our toll-free number at 888-874-4888. Once more, for the newcomers, it is 888-874-4888. That's our toll-free number at PRN. And if you would like to email in your questions and concerns, you may do that through my personal email, which is up, ready, and running all the time and ready to receive your emails. And the address is RM, that's Richard Martin, at GFAWD. GFAWD, it's for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design. That's the company when I'm working here in Singapore.com. Once more, let me give you the email address. RM at GFAWD.com. And if you would like to call me in private with your personal economic and financial concerns, you may do that. Just leave a message, a phone number, and a name, and I will call you back if I am not able to talk to you, but hopefully I will be, and you may call any time within the 24-hour period, because our times are different, as I'm sure you will appreciate. The direct number to call is in Sarasota, Florida, at area code 941-441-1682. Once again, 941-441-1682. Okay, so please feel free to use any of those means of contact. I will be very, very happy to talk to you. Well, I have to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that nothing has changed. Unbelievably, despite all that has happened over the last 2.5 years, together with the loss of $30 trillion from the financial system, banks are still free to issue bogus mortgages to unemployed applicants with bad credit, just as they were before the meltdown, and they can still produce securitized debt without retaining even a meager 5% of the loan's value. Also, government agencies cannot force non-bank financial institutions to increase their capital, even though a slight downturn in the market could wipe them out and could cause severe damage to the rest of the system. Wall Street has prevailed on all counts, and now the window for re-regulating the system has conveniently closed. The Obama administration understands the problem perfectly well, but they also know that they won't be re-elected without Wall Street's help. That's why Obama promised to further reduce what he called burdensome regulations in the Wall Street Journal just 2 weeks ago. His op-ed was intended to preempt the release of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission's report, which was expected to make recommendations for strengthening existing regulations. Obama has come down on the side of big finance, thus ensuring another market downturn. You know, the deindustrialization of the U.S. has been going on since Reagan and before. Reagan opened the free trade bottle with the signing of the FTA, and it hasn't been shut ever since. Bush Sr. created NAFTA, and Bill Clinton signed it into law because Bush couldn't get reelected. It was Clinton who undid the Glass-Steagall Act, put in place after the Great Depression to prevent another one, and created the WTO. While all that was going on, what was most of the population concerned about? Boxers or briefs, moniker-scented cigars and sexual relations, or, to fast forward, sports, fantasy sports, American Idol, or any other thing but the reality of everyday life. It was Bush Jr. who gave most favored nation status to the Chinese, which allowed every company, big and small, to export jobs, technology, and manufacturing techniques to them. I think there is a significant risk that the Chinese will nationalize production at some point in the future, which of course will remove the assets from outside control. I don't know if that in itself will lead to war. Maybe, maybe not if they time it right. By the way, it was Bush Jr. who built the police state apparatus around everybody. So when people do figure out that both parties have been representing the interests of those other than the complete apathetic, ill-informed, ignorant masses of the USA, the people won't be able to do anything about it. I should add that it was also Bush Jr. who bailed out the banking system against the directly stated will of the American people, which is not much different from Obama, who bailed out everyone and passed the odious health care law against the will of the people. So frankly, when you ask whose fault all this is, Americans only need to look in the mirror to find the answer. They allowed this to happen by being apathetic in a system of government that pursues the exact opposite of the wishes of the electorate. There is also a warning in everything we are experiencing for those of you that know history. Corporate fascism, not socialism, is what America has been living under for quite some time. But right around the corner looms the authoritarian variety. And I fear that we're getting to the point where people will refer to America in future history books as the Fourth Reich. All right. Very, very, very disturbing, ladies and gentlemen, all this. And I don't know where it leaves you all. But there isn't much time. You need to take your steps, as I have described, and you need to do what has to be done to protect yourself. And as I said to you last week, my job here on the wake-up call is to protect you. The United States of America must look after itself. I am here to represent your interests, each and every one of you as individuals, plus your families. That's my brief here on the wake-up call, ladies and gentlemen, and that's how it will remain. Well, other than what I've already said about the decline in the unemployment rate, the ridiculous decline in the unemployment rate a few minutes ago, I really don't have much else to say. You know, as you know, it came out at 9%, which is down 0.4% from the previous month, despite the huge number of people who gave up looking for work. As far as the number of people who are not in the labor force but who want a job now, just hit 6,643,000, a jump of 431,000 from December, and the highest number in history. These are people who would send the unemployment rate to about 12.8% if they were in the labor force and looking for a job. Nothing else really needs to be said. Okay, a couple of emails here. Let's look, first of all, Steve Kruger has come in, as he always does, because he seems to be an avid writer and always has been ever since pretty much the beginning of the show, years ago. So he says, and he quotes, "Retiring outside the U.S. no longer a foreign concept. Retiring in another country used to be a foreign concept to most Americans, but it's becoming more common thanks to two main factors, the internet and the economy. All you have to do is think outside the border," one expat said. "Richard, CNBC is starting to sound like the wake-up call. Do you think they will be boarding up their windows and leaving the states?" "I don't think so either, but at some point they will realize that this monopoly is over." Steve Kruger. Yes, Steve, they will. And you will know that you've hit rock bottom when the listenership of CNBC is so low that they probably cancel the program, as it is there are far too many economic and financial programs on TV as it is. Some of them will go, and it wouldn't surprise me at all if CNBC wasn't one of them. It's already sharply down in its viewership from 3 or 4 years ago, and I wouldn't be surprised to see it go down much, much further still. But first of all, we have to live through the mini bubble that we seem to be having in all these different traded markets. So let that play itself out, and then we'll have another look. All right. Well, over the weekend, I sent out what I call a weekend reading article to my email distribution subscribers, containing a long article about Ireland, written by Michael Lewis, called When Irish Eyes Are Crying, and it's from Vanity Fair, for those of you who are interested, and it's a very interesting article, I highly recommend it. Just Google Vanity Fair and select the article When Irish Eyes Are Crying and read it. It's very long, but I think, I hope those of you who read it did enjoy it. But I'd like to take just four paragraphs from it, showing how feckless Merrill Lynch is or was in the Department of Analysis at the time. It's truly an eye-opener, ladies and gentlemen, so it deals with one of Wall Street's more egregious scandals, which has unfortunately received little or no attention. So here we go. The bank analyst who had been most prescient and interesting about the Irish banks worked for Merrill Lynch. His name was Philip Ingram. In his late 20s, and a bit quirky, at the University of Cambridge he had studied zoology. Ingram had done something original and useful. He'd shone a new light on the way Irish banks lent against commercial real estate. The commercial real estate loan market is generally less transparent than the market for home loans. Deals between bankers and property developers are one-offs, on terms unknown to all but a few insiders. The parties to any loan always claim it is prudent. A bank analyst has little choice but to take them at their word. But Ingram was skeptical of the Irish banks. He had read Morgan Kelly's newspaper articles and even paid Kelly a visit in his university office. To Ingram's eyes, there undoubtedly appeared to be a vast difference between what the Irish banks were saying and what was really happening. To get at it, he ignored what they were saying and went looking for knowledgeable insiders in the commercial property market. He interviewed them, as a journalist might. On March the 13th, 2008, 6 months before the Irish real estate Ponzi scheme collapsed, Ingram published a report in which he simply quoted verbatim what British market insiders had told him about various banks lending to commercial real estate. The Irish banks were making far riskier loans in Ireland than they were in Britain. But even in Britain, the report revealed, they were the nuttiest lenders around. In that category, Anglo-Irish, Bank of Ireland, and AIB came in that order, first, second, and third. For a few hours, the Merrill Lynch report was the hottest read in the London financial markets, until Merrill Lynch retracted it. Merrill had been a lead underwriter of Anglo-Irish's bonds and the corporate broker to AIB. They'd earned huge sums of money off the growth of Irish banking. Moments after Phil Ingram hit the send button on his report, the Irish banks called their Merrill Lynch bankers and threatened to take their business elsewhere. The same executive from Anglo-Irish who had called to scream at Morgan Kelly called a Merrill research analyst to scream some more. Ingram's superiors at Merrill Lynch hauled him into meetings with in-house lawyers who toned down the report's pointed language and purged it of its dabbing quotes from market insiders, including its many references to Irish banks. And from that moment, everything Ingram wrote about Irish banks was edited and bowdlerized by Merrill Lynch's lawyers. At the end of 2008, Merrill fired him. One of Ingram's colleagues, a fellow named Ed Olchin, was also made to apologize to Merrill's investment bankers individually for the trouble he caused them by suggesting there was still money to be made on shorting Irish banks. It would have been difficult for Merrill Lynch's investment bankers not to know, at some level, that in a reckless market, the Irish banks had acted with a recklessness all their own. But in the 7-page memo to Brian Lenihan, for which the Irish taxpayer forked over to Merrill Lynch 7 million euros, they kept whatever reservations they may have had to themselves. All of the Irish banks are profitable and well capitalized, wrote the Merrill Lynch advisers, who then went on to suggest that the bank's problem wasn't at all the bad loans they had made, but the panic in the market. The Merrill Lynch memo listed a number of possible responses the Irish government might have to any run on Irish banks. It refrained from explicitly recommending one course of action over another, but its analysis of the problem implied that the most sensible thing to do was guarantee the banks. After all, the banks were fundamentally sound, promised to eat all losses, and markets would quickly settle down, and the Irish banks would go back to being in perfectly good shape. As there would be no losses, the promise would be free. Well, that's Merrill Lynch for you. Think back to bankrupting Orange County, the investment banking scandals of the 1990s, the analysts' scandals of the 2000s, the derivatives disaster of CDOs, and now Ireland. All quite self-explanatory, I should say. Well, according to CNBC, economists were expecting the U.S. economy to add 145,000 jobs during January. Obviously, the 36,000 figure was a huge disappointment. Approximately 150,000 jobs need to be added to the economy each month just to keep up with population growth. The government jobs report also indicated that 504,000 people, quote, dropped out of the labor force in January. So what happened to those 500,000 people? Did they all win the lottery? Have they all become independently wealthy? Did they all die? No. The vast majority of them are still around, and the vast majority of them are still desperately seeking jobs. It's just that the government doesn't count them as looking for work anymore. According to the latest numbers from Gallup, the unemployment rate actually increased to 9.8% at the end of January. Gallup's measure of underemployment, those that are unemployed plus those that are working part-time but want full employment, was sitting at 18.9% at the end of January. There are approximately 28 million people without work who would like full-time jobs. According to Zero Hedge, the number of Americans that are not in the labor force but that would like a job right now has hit an all-time record high. If you add all of those people into the unofficial unemployment figure, it would jump to 12.8%. According to Calculated Risk, this is the deepest and most brutal employment downturn that the United States has experienced since World War II. The current employment downturn started 37 months ago, and there is no indication that we will return to pre-recession levels anytime soon. The U.S. Labor Department has also announced that job growth during 2010 was much weaker than they had previously reported. The numbers for 8 months were revised down, and the numbers for 4 months were revised up. after all of the revisions are accounted for, it turns out that a total of 215,000 fewer jobs were created during 2010 than originally calculated. All absolute nonsense. Just very depressing. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have come to that moment in time which is called our break. Therefore, I shall take a break and be right back.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, this is Dr. Meir Eisenstein. Every Thursday morning, 10 a.m. Eastern Time, I will be coming to you live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I will bring my background as a physician and as an attorney to help you with a minimal pharmaceutical and a minimal surgical approach to your medical issues. Please come join me.
So to join in on the conversation, call 888-874-4888. Ask Dr. Eisenstein, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, only on Progressive Radio Network.
This is Glenn Ford. Join me and co-host Nellie Bailey every Monday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time for Black Agenda Radio, an hour of news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. That's Black Agenda Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.
Driving you crazy? Do you have a cheating boyfriend or girlfriend? An ex you can't let go of? An obnoxious boss? Adult kids who won't listen? I'm Hollis Polk, and I fix relationship problems. Your life, your relationship with Hollis Polk offers you practical solutions for all sorts of people problems. Listen and call in Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 3 p.m. Pacific, or download the podcast at ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
You're listening to Bhavani, and I'd like to welcome you every Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network to join me for my show called I Eat Green, where every Wednesday we will talk about eating healthy and eating sustainably for our planet. So join me every Wednesday from 5 to 6.
You're listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Okay, well, we are back, and I would like to start with an email from a gentleman called Adrian, who I do not know, and would appear to have been a listener for a while, and I got a very long email from him, and I thought that I would like to read it to you, because I think it's interesting, and it is very apropos, as they say. So, here is the email from Adrian. Dear Richard, thank you for the very interesting information on employment in Singapore. I will keep you informed as I progress. I reviewed my rant and made a couple of minor adjustments, and if you think it's still up to snuff, feel free to read it to all and sundry. I have been an avid listener for about 6 months. In fact, the first program I tuned into, you replied to a listener who had complained about your diction and presentation, saying that you appear to be in glee as you presented your views and information on what you see as the upcoming economic disaster. As a fellow Brit, I much appreciate both your diction and perfect command of the English language. Excellent style, very pithy. Well done. Kudos to you, sir. Also, as a Brit, I find criticizing the USA, I come off sounding very chauvinistic. Case in point, I tell co-workers that every time I travel home, I see giant improvements in the infrastructure and public transportation system. Yet the commute into New York City from New Jersey looks and feels the same as it did 40 years ago, just with a million more bodies that added to the daily chaos. Americans don't understand how far they're falling behind. The governor of New Jersey recently cancelled work on a new tunnel into New York City and was applauded for doing so, condemning yet another generation to a soon-to-be 100-year-old transit system. In an interview on NPR, a woman commuter was asked her thoughts on the cancellation. She reported that she thought that it was a good idea to cancel the dig if we couldn't afford it and would rather not see her taxes go up and would continue to spend 3 hours a day commuting. I am guessing that the poor woman is totally unaware of the money she spent rearranging rocks in Afghanistan and Iraq while supporting corrupt governments around the world, not to mention the complete stupidity of spending trillions of dollars to chase down 1,000, plus or minus, according to the Pentagon, goat-herding Taliban. On the subject of the cost of wars, I recently read Trafalgar companion Alexander Stilwell in the introduction. Professor John B. Hettendorf lays out how France was broke after supporting the colonies in the War of Independence. Napoleon, knowing that he was going to war with England, made the Louisiana sale to pay for his adventures. This, plus many devious alliances with Austria, which cost France nothing, made the campaign possible. Unlike the U.S. government, who is putting the bill for the wars of national credit card, adding to that debt, I was told on my arrival in the Berkshires, southwestern Massachusetts, for a long weekend, that General Dynamics had won a contract to build a new warship and would be hiring 500 workers. Whoopee! Just what we need. Another useless boat and another couple of $100 million in debt and no nice new tunnel into New York. Of course, there is the question of what is the bright new boat going to do after all the days of gunboat tactics are over. The only other employment for the boat will be displaying the USA's mile around the world. Might around the world. While 30 million plus Americans can't afford health care, I arrived here in 1974 on a whim and as an economic refugee from the turmoil in the UK. I'm sure you'll remember the bus, rail, and power strikes. I have never felt any great love for the witless leadership in any of the White Houses. In fact, the best so far has been Jimmy Carter. That is putting the bar very low. Since the Carter administration, the U.S. government has not cared one iota about the country and its people, but only the interests of small groups. Like many people in a small group, I have benefited in a small way. The patron saint of conservatives followed Mr. Carter. Mr. Reagan complained in the campaign that Mr. Carter had built up the national debt so large that the equal amount of dollar bills placed on top of each other would reach to the moon. As we know, Mr. Reagan suffered from memory loss. Therefore, we can't blame him, adding to the debt pile millions morefold. One of my fondest memories of the Reagan administration was the great emptying out of mental hospitals, of which time it was impossible to walk down a Manhattan street without seeing someone talking to him or herself. Reagan's crowning glory was the trickle-down theory, or more commonly known as voodoo economics. I am sure students still pay the Walton School thousands of dollars to learn that theory. In leaving the UK, I was hoping to leave behind class warfare in the form of the Tory Party. A few years later, Mrs. Thatcher, who I knew from art school days as the milk snatcher, took the reins. My dad called her perfectly on her election. "She will get us into a war," he exclaimed. As if on cue, she started a war over a couple of million sheep in the South Atlantic. Perfectly timed to keep the Britons' eyes off the ball while the Thatcher government converted the UK into a service economy from a manufacturing economy. Germany, meanwhile, was not as stupid and kept its industry and is now, once again, it has an economy the envy of Europe. Watch out for those old jealousies reappearing. My mum still thinks that Ron and Maggie were having an affair. Not to be outdone, New Labour sold the British working man down the drain, as did Slick Willie, sold what was left of the American unions, blue-collar workers, and the Democratic Party down the drain with the signing of NAFTA. Ross Perot told us what would happen with his charts and the great sucking sound of jobs leaving America. The pure genius of Mr. Clinton was to screw up this country and Central America's economy, then parade himself around like an elder statesman. Most normal societies would have had him hung, drawn, and quartered for treason but instead he got his own special on TV. In a recent program, you said that historians would see the invasion of Iraq as the beginning of the end of the USA. I would argue it was the signing of NAFTA that was the first sounding of the death knell. Tony Blair's cool Britannia was very costly all round. At least Britain didn't fall for the euro, but got itself tricked into stupid wars. Expect to see Tony the Poodle's head on a pike somewhere soon. In the US, confusion reigns over which party represents which group. Which party represents which group? My 10-year-old son asked me to describe the difference between the Democrats and the GOP. My reply was simple. Son, there is no difference. In fact, neither party knows the difference either. To prove the point, in the mid-90s, the parties switched colors. GOP from blue to red and the Democrats from red to blue, and no one noticed. Political imagery is totally lost on modern-day America. The lawn sign for a local Republican contestant, Roland Rolly Stratton, had a giant red star in the middle of his name. Maybe the People's Republic of China, thanks to the Supreme Court, was funding him. Where are Gilbert and Sullivan when you need them? With Bush Sr., we got to experience the first bank bailout in the form of the S&L debacle. This proved to be the bankers that will suck it up, as we did the second time with the QEs. Coincidentally, the day the news of Neil Bush's involvement in the Silverado Bank hit the front page of the New York Times, Daddy Bush started a war with his buddy Saddam Hussein. I won't comment on Bush Jr. Mum always told me never to make fun of the village idiot. The Daily Mirror summed up his re-election with a front page headline reading, "How could 59 million Americans be so stupid?" I can't comment on the present occupant of the White House other than to say the State of the Union address was, as you pointed out, a very bad joke. However, I'm sure the Speaker of the House is going to outdo the country in the tears department. Where in God's name did they find that idiot? All the richest country that has ever been on the planet can give us is John Boehner. On 60 Minutes, even his wife looked embarrassed to sit next to him as he sat sobbing. The best thing about John Boehner is he'll have the 1,000 plus or minus Taliban die laughing at us. Maybe that is the GOP's plan to fix the budget. Get everybody a job and put a chicken in every pot to have the rest of the world die laughing at us. Well, thank you very much, Adrian. Interesting and informative. Well, Mervyn King is Britain's chief central banker and a key figure in the global financial system. Last week, after surprising reports surfaced that the British economy had once again contracted in the fourth quarter of last year, King delivered a stern, sobering message to his country. Quote, "In 2011, real wages are likely to be no higher than they were in 2005. One has to go back to the 1920s to find a time when real wages fell over a period of 6 years. The Bank of England cannot prevent the squeeze on real take-home pay that so many families are now beginning to realize is the legacy of the banking crisis and the need to rebalance our economy. The squeeze on living standards is the inevitable price to pay for the financial crisis and subsequent rebalancing of the world 4% and 5% over the next few months. The idea that the MPC could have preserved living standards by preventing the rise in inflation without also pushing down earnings growth further is wishful thinking. Unpleasant though it is, the Monetary Policy Committee neither can nor should try to prevent the squeeze in living standards, half of which is coming in the form of higher prices and half in earnings rising at a rate lower than normal. I sympathize completely with savers and those who behaved prudently, now finding themselves among the biggest losers from the crisis. To summarize, one of the world's leading central bankers has looked his country in the eye, ladies and gentlemen, and admitted that he is completely powerless to prevent the inevitable decline in living standards that will result from years of reckless behavior. It's amazing that someone in his position would be so terse, so direct in his appraisal of the situation by nature of their positions. Central bankers are either serial liars who must continually deceive the public in order to set expectations and carry out their agenda. King's statement may be a sign that England is finally on its last legs. Fiscally, the country is in a similar situation as the U.S. and Europe, in debt up to its eyeballs, hemorrhaging cash, and quickly losing the confidence of the international community. Of course, what you don't hear in my rendition is King's own intonation. I actually thought about playing the speech to you over the air, but I realized I couldn't do it because of the way the poor guy speaks. I mean, you know, there was a time when people spoke competently and in sentences which one could actually hear from beginning to end. Those were the days when people had some pride and some courage and guts. But, you know, people just don't speak correctly anymore. You can't hear what they're saying half the time. You know, they trail off their words at the end of the sentences. Poor King sounds like he just came out of a schoolroom. He hasn't got the ability to carry his speech with him. So, frankly, it would have been impossible for me to play that speech to you. You know, it sounds to me like this poor man wants to get out of Parliament as quickly as he can and go home for lunch and put some more food on the table, you know, into that hideously extended belly. You know, the reason, frankly, is why I get no criticism on these things is because, quite frankly, I cannot attack the politicians. I won't attack politics. Politics is an empty game. The only time I talk about politicians and politics is when I actually have something to discuss about what they actually do. Their policies are meaningless and they just lead to pointless arguments. You know, a lot of people will disagree already with what I say. But you know, when it comes to what I say, people know they're going to have to sort of deal with a barrage of statistics that I give every week in support of my arguments. I'm not going to get involved with pie-in-the-sky political arguments. It's not worth my while, ladies and gentlemen. I'm sure each and every one of you have your own views about what kind of a tactic should apply when it comes to dealing with the affairs of the world. It's much more important for me to actually take those affairs of the world and deconstruct them so we can get to some kind of understanding as to what they're all about. Well, let me see, we have no questions, no emails. That's okay. So let me give you another email that I received last week from Kevin Moran, who I sent out to my distribution list the other day, an email entitled, One in Five Mortgages Default Again After Modification. And I got an interesting email back from Kevin in reply. He says, no surprise, except that it isn't much higher. The typical loan mod cuts the interest rate to as low as 2% for a period of years and defers, not forgives, repayment of principal for up to 10 years. What's left is a large loan on an underwater house. I personally know a homeowner who is seriously considering accepting that type of modification and then stopping mortgage payments until the bank comes to take the house. The house is at least $100,000 underwater. In New York, it can take 2 years to foreclose. An attorney is advising this homeowner. Thank you, Kevin. Interesting enough. Steve Kruger, came with another email saying, Richard, in September 2009, you sent out an article about the 500 ships anchored off your coast. Looking at this chart, I have to think that the fleet has since grown. Do your local papers discuss this, or does this remain a secret like it does here? Yes, quite a recovery. Steve Kruger. Well, Steve, am I going to be honest with you? I haven't looked out of the window in a few days. I haven't really seen, and it's pitch dark out here right now. It's almost 11 o'clock at night, so I can't. Actually, it's almost midnight. I'm looking at the wrong clock. When I come to my office, I consider I'm in the United States, so all the information, all the materials, all my emails and everything I have around me is based on the United States. So I have to kind of add back a kind of hour when I talk about, well, 13 hours actually, when I talk about Singapore time. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it is almost midnight here, and I must tell you that I cannot see out of my window, so I can't see if there are any ships out there or not. But I would say in answer to your question, Kevin, I doubt that they lie about that or just withhold the information. I think they're quite proud, actually. Lots of ships outside Singapore's little island here. Nice of them to sit out here. I expect a lot of them come ashore and spend some money here. But I'm sure there are a lot of ships out there wondering what to do with themselves, Kevin. I mean, you probably saw the chart I sent out of the Baltic Dry Index, BDI, which is making new lows every day of the week, which frankly gives the lie to the idea that there is any kind of recovery in the economy whatsoever. But be that as it may, I'm sure there are a lot of ships waiting for business. All right, well, Bill Adamo came in with an email saying, Richard, is this statement true? Energy prices are rising swiftly, reflecting rapid growth in the emerging economies, according to Dominic Strauss-Kahn. I don't believe it is true, Bill. No, I think energy prices are rising swiftly because Ben Bernanke is throwing billions of dollars into the market every day of the week. Those dollars do not have a home. Nobody wants to spend the money. Nobody wants to lend the money. Nobody wants to borrow the money, for that matter. And so the money simply has no home. And so where does the money go? Goes into the stock market, goes into commodities, completely ruins the entire economy worldwide and causes upsets and revolutions in countries like Egypt. Just too bad. But I don't think it's anything to do with demand. That's not my understanding at all, Bill. Okay, well, a little word on the healthcare industry. As you probably know, the healthcare bill was struck down by a judge, a federal judge the other day, who said it was unconstitutional. Well, I'm sure you know that the healthcare industry in the United States is one gigantic money-making scam, and that tens of millions of families now live in great fear of illness and disease. The prospect of racking up tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars in medical debt is enough to frighten anyone. Today, virtually every single person is one really bad day away from financial ruin. Medical bills are the number one reason for bankruptcy in the United States. Did you know that the vast majority of people that go bankrupt due to medical bills actually do have health insurance? Meanwhile, there are a significant number of people that are becoming fabulously wealthy off this system. The so-called healthcare industry has turned large numbers of doctors, lawyers, health insurance company executives, and pharmaceutical company executives into multimillionaires. The healthcare industry has been so corrupt and so greedy for so long that we don't remember what a legitimate medical system ever looked like. Obamacare has been hailed as the solution to many of the healthcare problems in the U.S., but the truth is that it doesn't solve any of them. In fact, it's almost certain to increase healthcare costs. Health insurance companies all over the country have already announced plans to raise premiums substantially because of this new law. Not that anyone is proposing anything better. Repealing Obamacare is a great idea, but beyond that, nobody has any real solutions for the ongoing healthcare nightmares. The system simply doesn't work, and it's causing millions of people to go bankrupt. So yes, let's repeal Obamacare. It's one of the worst pieces of legislation that the Congress ever passed in all U.S. history. However, just repealing Obamacare will not fix America's healthcare problems. It won't do anything to address the nightmarish statistics. As I just said, even if you do have health insurance, you're just one really bad accident or one really bad illness away from bankruptcy, unless you're fabulously wealthy. It's easy to rack up $10,000, $20,000, or even $30,000 in medical debt at a moment's notice, and many hospitals are becoming extremely aggressive about collecting on those medical debts. And I'm sure many of you know exactly what I'm talking about. One trip to the hospital can wipe out years of financial savings. There are a lot of people that this system really benefits, and unfortunately, that does not include middle-class Americans. According to a report published in the American Journal of Medicine, medical bills cause more than 60% of the personal bankruptcies in the United States. According to that same study, approximately three-quarters of those that do go bankrupt because of medical bills actually do have health insurance. If you have an illness that requires intensive care for an extended period of time, it's easy to rack up medical bills that total over $1 million. It's estimated that hospitals overcharge people by about $10 billion every single year. One trained medical billing advocate says that over 90% of the medical bills that she has audited contain gross overcharges. It's not uncommon for insurance companies to get hospitals to knock their bills down by up to 95%. But if you're uninsured or you don't know how the system works, then you're out of luck. One study found that approximately 41% of working-age Americans either have medical bill problems or are currently paying off medical debt. Health insurance premiums for small employers in the United States increased 180% between 1999 and 2009. Even as the rest of the country struggled with a deep recession, health insurance companies increased their profits by 56% during 2009 alone. Between 2000 and 2006, wages increased by 3.8%, but healthcare premiums increased by 87%. According to a report by Healthcare for America Now, America's five biggest for-profit health insurance companies ended 2009 with a combined profit of $12.2 billion. The top executives at the five largest for-profit health insurance companies ended 2009 with a combined profit of $12.2 billion. The top executives of the five largest for-profit health insurance companies received nearly $200 million in total compensation in 2009. Health insurance premiums are once again soaring in 2011. Blue Shield of California recently announced plans to raise health insurance rates by an average of 30 to 35% this year, and some individual policyholders could actually see their health insurance premiums rise by a whopping 59%. There were more than two dozen pharmaceutical companies that made over $1 billion in profits in 2008. According to one doctor interviewed by Fox News, a gunshot wound to the head, chest, or abdomen will cost $13,000 at his hospital the moment the victim comes through the door, and then there will be significant additional charges depending on how bad the wound is. Lawyers are certainly doing their part to contribute to soaring health care costs. According to one recent study, the medical liability system added approximately $55.6 billion to the cost of health care in 2008. According to a recent report, people spend about twice as much as residents of other developed countries on healthcare, but they receive much lower quality and far less efficiency in return. Approximately 46 million people do not currently have any health insurance at all. That means that 46 million people are just one bad day away from financial ruin without any protection whatsoever. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'd say it speaks for itself. I don't know about you, but definitely this is a crisis. And the point that I keep trying to make in all this when I talk to you about these things is that there really is no solution. I can go through the background to these problems, as I tend to do, ad infinitum. I can give you the where's and why for, the whys and wherefores as to how we got there, but I cannot give you the solutions. There used to be solutions, that's the sad part. There was a time when there were solutions to these problems. But like all cancers that basically keep spreading unopposed, you get to the point of no return. And we have arrived at that point. We arrived at that point somewhere in the last couple of years, where no amount of going back can save the system. And we will soon be at the point where every penny that's taken in U.S. taxes will go to paying off the deficit. And when we arrive at that point, ladies and gentlemen, there will be no downside to the United States in reneging on its entire debt. And I leave it up to you to decide whether it will in fact do so. But we are rapidly approaching that point much more quickly than expected and projected, especially in Social Security. So with that rather somber appraisal, ladies and gentlemen, I have to tell you that we have again come to the end of the wake-up call for this Monday, 7th of February, and I hope you have enjoyed it. I will be back again on Friday. I wanted to wish you all a happy Chinese New Year last week, but couldn't do so. I shall wish you a belated happy Chinese New Year right now, and I will be back with you on Friday, same time, same place. Bye-bye till then.